Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal and family well-being and what's going on in our whole environment, the health of our food, water, air, earth, the health of our communities, and the health of our society. Each week on the show, we talk with different thought leaders, experts, authors, activists, and scientists about all these different facets of our interconnected world and how they affect us and our health. On today's show, I am delighted to have with us Kristen Lawless. She is the author of a terrific new book just out from St. Martin's Press called Formerly Known as Food. The subtitle is How the Industrial Food System is Changing Our Minds, Bodies, and Culture. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Kristen Lawless.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is a really terrific book, so I just, you know, want to thank you for such an incredible yo woman's effort. And you, really have a way of educating the reader and kind of getting into all kinds of important and, in some cases, to some people, mystifying or ignored, or assumed corners of what's going on in our world in terms of our food and how that affects us. And, of course, in the book, you talk quite a bit about something which is a big news topic of the week, this particular week as the show is airing, because that is breastfeeding, breast milk versus formula, infant formula, and, you know, the differences for babies when they start out in life with one versus when they start out in life with the other. And you have talked to a lot of scientists who have a lot to, you know, of wisdom and science, really, to, to deepen our understanding of that. And, you know, it's particularly relevant this week because our current president, President Trump, basically has come out in opposition to a resolution for breastfeeding, in contrast to the standing wisdom of families all over the world, World Health Science experts, and, you know, the kind of overall agreement that where possible, where doable, mother's milk is the healthiest for children. And that's the purpose of what has been this United Nations affiliated World Health Assembly longstanding resolution, where in just the last couple of days, this administration has come out against mother's milk and in favor of infant formula. First of all, mother's milk is, you know, breastfeeding isn't something every woman can do, but women do have come to understand, and even in this country where we kind of got civilized away from our kind of natural common sense, as you so brilliantly detail in the book, we got kind of civilized away from eating the kinds of foods that your grandmother and all our grandparents ate, with very harmful consequences. You know, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about how we have been acculturated away from the healthiest food for us and gotten used to and confined our eating patterns to food that is industrially produced and lacking in nutrients and not as healthy?
Sure. Well, in the past roughly 75 to 100 years, the industrial food system has really taken over our sort of common sense about what's healthy and what's not healthy, and that the industry has subverted these longstanding wisdom that came down through the generations. I talk about my grandmother in the introduction to the book. She was born in 1918. I say, imagine the 19 20s, 30s, 40s, she's eating much more nutrient-dense food than we're eating today. I talk about the fact that she and her family were eating animal fats because that was traditionally considered a healthful food. She never really fell sway to the marketing claims of big food that told us we should switch to things like margarine, processed vegetable oils, highly refined breakfast cereals, low-fat milk, all of these creations of the industry. She never bought into it, and fortunately for me, that got passed down to my parents and on to me. But what I've learned as a nutrition educator and working with doctors is that the vast majority of people in this country and abroad as well really have lost that wisdom, and they are misled by the industry in many ways and don't have a clear conception of what's healthy anymore. And I point out in the book that many of our dietary guidelines are coming down from industry itself. And so that's where all this confusion comes from.
In other words, we think that the government recommends it or that scientists are recommending it, but actually, as you detail in the book, a lot of the foods, a lot of the additives, a lot of the ingredients have never been studied on their own for safety. They have never been studied in combination, in the combinations that we consume them. And in your book, you also cover that this is true for both, you know, food ingredients and food products. It's also true for toxic exposures on the other side of the fence, the things that, you know, we're exposed to and are also affecting our health that aren't really studied fully. So, you know, when it comes to a food product like infant formula, it has all of the attributes that, you know, that helps have been used to help sell us industrial foods. It's convenient. You don't have to go through the kind of planning and doing all of what's necessary, or even in fact being in a healthy state yourself. You know, you can just whip this thing up, the powder, and you know, it's a lot easier. So convenience has often, you know, been used. It's been the rationale, but it's like the fact that we're, you know, working harder with less time to do some of these things we never question, you know, the things that were traditionally done that we had time for, you know, on whose behalf are we, you know, having to work so hard that we can't even take, you know, it's really kind of unfeasible for some people to take these additional steps, you know, right, to actually prepare wholesome food or, you know, to nurse their children. I mean, what happens to our health? What happens to the health of people when they go down the industrial food pathway?
Well, if we want to start with talking about infant formula versus breast milk, I think it's a good place to start because in many cases that's the first processed food that we're all exposed to. It's important to remember it's a very relatively new invention, and it wasn't really widely accepted until the 1950s when it was, you know, affordable and doctors really started pushing it, and mothers were encouraged to feed formula. In fact, even my grandmother told me, despite her, you know, concerns about the you know, learning about the food industry, she at that time thought that infant formula was better because she really trusted her doctor, and her doctor said, this is better for the babies. And there were, you know, hospitals were handing out these goodie bags with infant formula samples. So many women interpreted that as a medical seal of approval and felt it was, you know, the right thing to do. Problem is, we now know so much more about the complexity and importance of breast milk. So there are, you know, I mean, like you mentioned in the beginning, it's irrefutable the benefits of breastfeeding. Every agency in the world recognizes this. The World Health Organization says, you know, you should feed your baby breast milk for 12 months at least, and 2 years if possible. The American Academy of Pediatrics also says 12 months, and continue to supplement with breast milk if you can while the baby's, you know, introduced to new foods. So, and there are the health benefits that most people know about are things like decreased risk of asthma, decreased risk of obesity, ear infections, eczema, diarrhea, sudden infant death syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. These are well-known established benefits of breastfeeding. What I talk about a lot in the book is some lesser-known factors, and I think they're so important, and in fact, one of the findings that I talk about in the book, which was probably one of the most shocking things to me, is the fact that over the course of the last couple of generations, there is a bacteria that was in the infant gut. So we're talking about the microbiota, which is the collection of bacterial cells in the gut and all over our bodies. I focus primarily on the health of the gut. There was this one strain that dominated the lower intestine of the infant gut. It was known as B. infantis. It is known as B. infantis for short. This one strain is highly protective. And what it does is it crowds out all the other bad or pathogenic bacteria that's in the gut and allows the baby to be healthy. It's the research that I highlight in the book has linked it to all kinds of things. The disappearance of it is linked to things like allergies and eczema, on to other issues like brain development and cancers later in life, heart disease, obesity. I mean, it's some of the research is preliminary, but this is what it's pointing towards. So what's happened over the past couple of generations is this one strain of bacteria is completely extinct in the Western world. 9 out of 10 American babies do not have this bacteria. It still exists in less industrialized countries. And the reason the researchers think is, and this is coming out of UC Davis, is that with the increase in C-sections, the overuse of antibiotics, and, of course, the introduction of infant formula, we've rendered it extinct. So, and the crucial point about this is the only way this bacteria can proliferate in the gut of a baby is if it is fed breast milk. Breast milk contains this carbohydrate. It's an oleosaccharide. It's the third most abundant component in breast milk, and it only feeds the bacteria. So this is, in fact, how they figured out what was going on. They were studying the components of breast milk. They found that this was the third most abundant component, and they said that babies can't digest it. Why on earth would it be there if the baby can't digest it? And then they realized, oh, it's feeding the bacteria. So one of the researchers, Bruce German at UC Davis, said to me that that was like a revelation, and he realized it's as important to feed the bacteria as it is to feed the baby. So this is, like, to me, just points to just how important it is that we have these systems in our body, and they work beautifully with the way that, you know, nature intended them to. That's not just like some romantic idea. This is an actual, like, scientific based, you know, finding that just kind of blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing. The other thing that you say in the book is that mother's milk is actually a self-adjusting thing. It's not like it's a recipe. Every mother's milk is the same. Every mother's milk is in one individual mother is the same day after day after day. But in fact, there are, you know, biological mechanisms that are more complex and able to kind of adjust things than, you know, we would ever imagine. I mean, what is going on? Because you say in the book that a mother can actually adjust her milk to the child's needs in order to protect them in various ways. Like, how does that happen?
There's a couple ways. One is that when the baby is nursing, the saliva from the baby's mouth actually enters into the nipple, and the woman's body, in the breast and the body, can detect if there's something there that needs fighting, and then the mother produces antibodies or whatever's needed to fight off whatever the baby has been exposed to. The mother also picks up all kinds of things when you're in close contact with your baby, you're kissing, you're hugging your baby, you're picking up all these things off the body. Your breast milk then adjusts to provide customized immune support for whatever it is your baby needs. And that's just, like, astonishing when you think about it, but it goes to show why the health benefits that I mentioned early on, like preventing things like allergies and eczema, but also like ear infections and diarrhea and vomiting, all these things that because babies are picking up, you know, bad bugs, basically, you're providing what the baby needs to fight those off. I mean, I think babies who are breastfed are just, you know, ear infections is a big problem, but babies who are breastfed have, I forget the exact percentage, but it's a significant fewer amount of ear infections than formula-fed babies. So you know, it's just, as I say in the book, it's a miraculous substance. And, you know, when we just think we can replace it with infant formula, we're doing a lot more harm than we really kind of ever imagined.
I mean, how did they even detect that this was happening? Somebody went and measured mother's milk and you know, kind of analyzed its components. And, I mean, how does this
well,
even happen?
All kind of, well, because fortunately we have very many talented scientists that are studying this and recognize the value in studying women and studying children and babies and, you know, this. I mean, Bruce German at UC Davis says, like, breast milk is, understanding breast milk and understanding the mother-infant dyad, he calls it, is like the Rosetta Stone for nutrition because it's the most perfect food. It's been honed over the course of the entire, you know, evolution of mammals on this planet. It's like the one food that is just like, you know, known to be perfect. So that's why researchers are studying it. There's another group of researchers I talk about in the book. They're in Philadelphia at the Monell Chemical Census Center, and they found that when a woman breastfeeds and when she eats, you know, preferably she's eating a whole foods and balanced, healthy diet, the flavors of all these different foods, they come through into the milk, and then the baby is learning from the flavors in the milk about what to expect when he or she starts eating solid foods. By contrast, when a baby is fed formula, there's no change. It's the monotonous flavor. It never changes. The baby's just used to the same thing over and over again. They're going to be a lot less likely to accept the wide range of diverse flavors that are found in our diets when we eat, you know, when we eat a whole foods diet. And there's very strong flavors in things like, you know, broccoli or Brussels sprouts, for example. And when you eat those foods, the baby gets used to them. So that, again, like those researchers said the same thing, like it's this amazing system that, you know, we've honed forever and we're subverting it in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, like this resolution could remove the supports to help more women
mm-hmm.
do it so that more babies
mm-hmm.
are getting this infant formula and with it the effects on the immune system, the
right.
effects on microbiome, and the effects on taste preference.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of like whenever I, you know, like you, I cover a lot of these topics that have to do with
yeah.
How corporate industry choices impact health, you know, and there are many,
right.
many ways
mm-hmm.
that they do. And, you
mm-hmm.
know, whenever you have a late, you know, recent egregious example of it, like this one with Trump, for, you know, the Trump administration,
right.
people will say,
mm-hmm.
oh, yes, again, they prefer their profits for
mm-hmm.
our health. And this has been kind of the MO for a while. I mean, it's not
right.
like, you know, anyone who's paying attention, which many people aren't, but many people also are, and, you know, can see this. It's kind of obvious, but it's like, so inherent in that is a kind of critique of capitalism and of the structures that kind
mm-hmm.
of make our, you know, that the highest priority, that some corporation
right.
or other will profit. And, you know, very likely that could have been the motivation for this, but we can't be mind readers of, like, what was going on with the current administration entirely. But,
right.
you know, at a certain point, just saying, yeah, there they go again, doing it for profits, it's like not enough. I mean, like, here
right.
they are affecting the lifelong health of,
right.
of, you know, I mean, you could say that maybe if they did it to Americans, that, you know, we deserved it because this is our political system. But they're doing it all around the world.
Right.
Like, what will
right.
be the health problems that children who perhaps otherwise would have had the option of having mother's milk, when instead they're fed this infant formula, what will they experience in terms of their health, the health of the next generation? What would that look like?
Well, I mean, the more likelihood for all those kind of chronic diseases I mentioned earlier, but also it's important that in many of these countries where there's poverty or women don't have access to clean water, there's that horrible history about Nestle and, you know, women using the watering down formula, babies dying, lots of babies dying. This is, around the world, a major problem. Even when women, when their nutrition is compromised because of the fact that they may be in poverty, the baby is still far better off getting breast milk than getting the infant formula. So, I mean, this is people around the world who work to promote, you know, healthy babies, infants and mothers around the world where there's poverty are just completely dumbfounded by this because it's just, it's been known for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's an established thing. Everyone agrees with it. As you point out in the book, formula isn't, sort of pushed on people in the hospital anymore. And, you know, the medical professions that you've mentioned are not really recommending it very highly. So there's actually, you also mentioned that the ingredients in it aren't studied for any health effect.
Right.
In other words, this is, can you go into that a little bit more?
Well, the point is that the FDA is not really very carefully monitoring what those so-called health claims are saying on the front of it. Because a lot of times you'll see things like, you know, just like mother's milk and helps with brain development, and then they add in maybe a couple fatty acids like DHA or AHA to say that it's very similar because, oh, you know, we see those in mother's milk too. But those claims are probably not correct, and the FDA isn't really monitoring what's going into them and if they are doing what they say, what they claim to say. One thing I just wanted to go back to, because you said the like lifelong health effects, and the sort of irony of a lot of this is that when you're talking about what breast milk prevents long-term, prevents things like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, these are the diseases that many, you know, middle-aged men are afflicted with. And if they would have been breastfed and if we would start doing this, you know, across the board, then we would see fewer of those kinds of diseases. And so it's just interesting that men are often the ones, you know, I mean, in this case, doing the promotion of infant formula when, you know, if we would promote breast milk, then these diseases of middle-aged men would be a lot less than they are now.
That's interesting. So, you know, it's possible, given the generation of men who are now in power, that they were born during the epoch when there was a kind of a, you know, suppression of nursing, and therefore they were likely themselves products of, you know, it's an unpleasant thought, really, to, you know, propagate this kind of person unwittingly, you know, through this.
Right. I know. And this is something, again, that I was kind of astounded by. Bruce German at UC Davis told me, like, we should have understood mother's milk and the benefits of it so long ago. But he attributes this to basically science focusing on the diseases of middle-aged, often rich and white men, like heart disease and, you know, those kinds of illnesses. He says science has been so solely focused on that, on, you know, keeping those men alive, that they completely missed what we should be focusing on, which is how you get started in life, the mother, the baby, what they're fed, you know? And, like, to me, that's a very important point.
Yeah, that's a huge thing because, you know, that is like the essential beyond gender moment because, you know, just a little baby, everybody starts out that way. It's basically sets, and that's what's so concerning about shifting the nutrition at that age. It's not like, oh, hey, they're babies, they'll get over it. They don't know what they're eating anyway, you know. It's actually, this is the developmental window, you know.
Exactly.
And then what if you don't, if a child misses that window in terms of getting the kind of immune protection, in terms of getting a diverse microbiota, all the things we've been talking about, it's not like, oh, whoops, I could give them something when they're four, and that's going to all make it up and all will be right.
No.
Maybe
you can't.
You can't
go back.
A little bit about what a developmental window is, in case somebody doesn't really know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, you know, and this begins in the womb, which is something I also talk about in the nutritional status of the mother. Obviously, we know, like with severe deficiencies, we see these gross birth defects. But when you're talking about, you know, there's more subtle changes that can happen when you're just maybe not, you know, completely deficient in nutrient, but you have, your levels are suboptimal. So what that does is it affects the development of all of the major systems in the body. I mean, that to me is like kind of common sense. And it's the same with when you're talking about breast milk. I mean, it builds the brain, you know, like there's fat and there's cholesterol in the breast milk. These are things that are important. There's omega-3 fatty acids. There's all kinds of things that are important for the structural building of the brain. And when you remove that from the baby's diet at that crucial juncture, of course you're going to be depriving the baby of, you know, maybe reaching their full potential in that sense. I mean, there are studies to show that, you know, there's some contradiction, you know, as there are in many studies, but there's some to show that, you know, babies who are breastfed have a higher IQ than babies who aren't breastfed. So that would, again, point to the time period when the brain is developing and how crucial that is.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, the other thing is, you know, this is yet another area. So it's not just allergies. It's not just prone to infections, chronic diseases in midlife. It's also brain development. And that is super important because, you know, we have people who are running the country, you know, it's not just one individual, who are, you know, emotionally disconnected from other people. They mentally, you know, perhaps like, you know, challenged in a number of different ways.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of anger, you know, and resentments,
right,
and other things.
Right.
And that, you know, so the brain is not just about, oh, I am a smart person with a high IQ, I can speak in a clear sentence and put several narrative thoughts together. It's also, you know, it also has a bearing on emotional intelligence and being able to process.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. And many breastfeeding advocates will, you know, talk a lot about, it's not just, obviously, you know, we mentioned all the health benefits, but the closeness, you know, the interaction that with the baby, these things also, you know, are just vitally important to developing, like, the emotional intelligence of a baby and all these other factors. And, you know, and you pointed out earlier, like, we have to always be mindful of the fact that, like, we don't have paid maternity leave in this country, and this gets to, you know, many women who want to breastfeed just can't because they're not making enough money, they don't have paid maternity leave, they have to go back to work in order to pay their bills. So there's this whole, you know, this whole political element to it that I talk about in the book too, where we need to start, I really am adamant about the fact that I think public health begins in the home. It's something that's often left out of the conversation around, you know, health and food and nutrition. But I want to bring that back into the conversation because we need to start allowing women the opportunity to breastfeed. And I think we would see enormous public health benefit once we started doing that.
Wow, that's a terrific initiative. That makes a lot of sense. You know, we're talking again today with Kristen Lawless, the journalist and author of Formerly Known as Food, for all you foodies out there, and I know a lot of food-oriented people listen to this program. Kristen's work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Newsweek, Vice, and Civil Eats, as well as in academic journals. She's a certified nutritional educator and works as a nutritional consultant in addition to being the author of this terrific book, which I'm highly recommending that everybody get. We'll be taking a break now on Connect the Dots, and we'll be back to talk more with Kristen in the second half of the show. Stay with us. Okay. We can resume. Okay?
Okay.
And we'll
okay,
do more
no
demos.
Problem.
Oh. Thank you. That was great.
Okay, good.
And 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you today, and we're talking with Kristen Lawless in the second half of the show, as well as the first author of the new book, Formerly Known as Food, How the Industrial Food System is Changing Our Minds, bodies, and culture. Very important topic, and we want to delve into it a little further from other angles. How did you first become aware of the fact that we've taken this kind of weird bypass in terms of the food that is eaten in this culture? Like, how did that first come to your awareness? How did you become interested in that? That led to the writing of this and all your reporting.
I think it was, I mean, I started, I've always been interested in, health and nutrition. I decided I wanted to go to school to formally study it. So I did that. I purposely sought out a school that is independent. It teaches a more of a holistic kind of nutrition, because in many cases, if you want to get an RD, which is if you're a registered dietitian, those schools, unfortunately, much of the nutrition information you'll learn there comes down from the industry itself, which I talk about in more detail in the book. But so I found a school where I could really study just nutrition without any of that influence. And I did that. I then went on to work with doctors and consult with their patients. And I was kind of astounded at the fact that, well, number one, the doctors don't have any nutrition education, like very little, and they don't understand these issues. They're often recommending the same things that the industry is promoting in the guidelines, not because they're trying to harm their patients or anything. They just don't have the knowledge or the education. And then when I was working with people in these offices and I was, like, figuring out that, It didn't matter what their background was. It doesn't matter any of it, and how your education, whatever, how much money you have. Everyone I worked with was completely confused and misled about nutrition and what constitutes a healthy diet. And I just felt like, I've always been a writer and a journalist, and I embarked on just getting deep into the research and figuring out all of it, because a lot of the patients would ask me for a book that they would, all the stuff I would tell them, they wanted a book, and there wasn't one book that encompassed all of this. You'd have to read a bunch of books and then, get into the scientific literature and everything else. So I wanted to write a book that would help, as many people as possible understand all these issues. It covers just this huge ground, and I just, I dedicate my book to the public because I feel like we have the right to know what's in our food, and many of us, we just don't anymore, and we're also confused, and so that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. One of the things that happens is that people, it gets normalized that people are eating, processed food of all kinds. And it's like, mm-hmm. for example, even now, both of us happen to belong to the Park Slope Food Co-op and have reported for their newspaper. And so, we're people who are trying to eat organic if possible, locally sourced, well-grown, mm-hmm. farm-grown food. We have that obviously as a high value. But mm-hmm. in looking at what's going on, for example, with the regulation of food in general, of organic food in particular, we have a situation where the very success of organic farm-grown food has also sprouted a whole industry of processed mm-hmm. food. Clif Bars, cookies, crackers, cereal, maybe marginally healthier than the conventional version. We now have the large companies have bought various organic lines such that, we have decisions that are made in the organic National Organic Standards Board that are, influenced by people making processed food, albeit with a natural organic label, and sometimes outweighing the voices of the farmers who are growing the healthy foods that that you describe and that both of us seek. And yet many people are like, again, as with the formula, it's a convenience. What are the problems mm-hmm. with industrial food?
Then I hope that your listeners will read the book to get to all of it. But I think, there's several key issues. One is our foods are now grown in depleted soil as a result of industrialization. You know, over the course of the past 75 or so years, the use of fertilizer, the use of chemical, you know, inputs, growing things and the monocrop, so just like one crop on huge acres, you know, large swaths of land. This has depleted the soil. Farmers aren't caring for the soil like they once did. Instead, they're just looking to increase yield as efficiently as possible. So there are studies to show that the nutrient density of just regular, you know, fruits and vegetables has decreased dramatically since the 1950s. So even when you're just talking about, you know, like whole foods, the nutrient density of them has gone down. Then you get into the packaged and processed foods. Those foods there's like 9,000 food chemical additives that are in the food supply. I think it's 1,000 of them have never even been tested for safety. We're eating a combination of them all the time, and they're definitely not tested in combination by anyone. Then there's the issue of the food packaging, which I have a chapter on that in the book, because I talk about something called endocrine disrupting chemicals, and these are chemicals that are found in plastics. And so, like, you know, any yogurt, milk, whatever you buy comes in plastic most of the time. And they know that the chemicals that are used to make those plastics is leaching into the food. And the many scientists I spoke to in the book who are studying this endocrine disruption are really alarmed by what they're seeing in their animal models. And so endocrine disrupting chemicals are chemicals that interfere with our hormonal systems. And so this affects nearly every process in the body, and especially, as we were talking about earlier, is especially problematic for fetuses in the womb, babies and children, when, as you mentioned, all their systems are developing and they have this crucial window. And when these chemicals, they interfere with hormonal processes, you can't go back and change it once it's been interrupted. And that's what these scientists are seeing in their laboratories. And so, I would say those are like the three kind of main issues that I go into more detail in the book. Oh, and then, of course, the microbiota, I should add, because the foods are so depleted of what we call dietary fiber, that's what feeds these beneficial bacteria in the gut. And when we remove that from our diet, which we have, those bacterial species begin to die off. And that, again, as I mentioned with the baby, that was one example, but it happens in the adult gut too. So I'd say those are the main issues.
Are the natural and healthy or organic products marginally better in terms of their ingredients, you're counseling healthy meats, fruits, vegetables, fats, and all the rest of it. Maybe let's do a sideline and just talk a little bit about, the vegan diet. Because, you know, the vegan diet would, in some cases, appear to be healthier in avoiding some of these, factory farm meat, for example, which is horrible, mm-hmm. and other things. Right. What's your stance on that?
Well, I think if you're a vegan because, like, ethically you disagree with the killing of animals for food, then, like, I say, then I totally understand that. I've been there. I was a vegetarian for a really long time. But if you're doing it from a health perspective, I think it's mostly misguided. Of course, there's some cases where I think, you know, like, those kinds of really heavily plant-based diets, if you're like have certain diseases and ailments, it can be really beneficial. But generally speaking for the population, I think a vegan diet in terms of health is not great. And especially when you're talking about women who want to become pregnant, women who are pregnant, women who are breastfeeding, there's so many crucial nutrients in animal fats and like an egg yolk and butter and cheese and steak with the fat and chicken with the skin. Again, foods that we've been eating for thousands and thousands of years. There's no traditional culture that's strictly vegan. Even like in India, they eat plenty of dairy products and yogurt. And so there's really no long-term kind of like health benefit that we've seen. And so that's, you know, and then, I mean, that said, if you are vegan, you should just be eating strictly whole foods that are just naturally vegan. And what there's this entire industry now around vegan processed foods and like those fake meats and fake cheeses. And like that to me is just, you should just stay as far away from that as possible because there's just nothing there, you know, that's good for you.
What is it specifically soybean in those products or is it the processing?
It's mostly soy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of soy. It's a lot of, they use like wheat gluten and things like that. And, but it's just chock full of all kinds of additives and emulsifiers and different flavorings and things to make it sort of mimic, you know, like what actual meat or cheese, although they do it poorly, in my opinion, but, you know, really tastes like. And so that's just not really food by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm. Right. So we have to kind of be a little bit more aware of what is being called food and we're coming to accept as food. You know, during our conversation, you mentioned nutrient density. And then just now in talking about these substitute products, you also said there's nothing there. You know, one of the things that's like if something looks like something or it kind of tastes like something, people aren't that cognizant about what, whether they're getting nutrition or not, you know, and what happens if I eat something that isn't giving me nutrition. And, you know, let's say I ate something, it's not giving me nutrition. Let's say it's not, a candy bar or something, you know, which is filled with sugar and, you know, obviously has problems. But what if I eat some kind of medium ground, but it doesn't really have nutrition, but I'm eating it anyway, and, like, what does that do?
Well, I mean, it really depends on what exactly you're talking about, but the one thing I will say is we often think of, like, people, you know, the biggest thing that I encounter is that people want to lose weight, and so they often think of, like, okay, I can't eat, like, all these things because I want to lose weight, but what people forget is that when you're deficient in nutrients and nutrition, it's a lot harder to lose weight, and so when I tell people, like, okay, you should drink the whole milk and eat the whole milk yogurt and eat the egg yolk and, you know, on and on, they're like, oh, this is, first of all, they're happy because they've been told to eat all this other stuff that tastes terrible, but they eat the whole food, they eat way more fat than they're used to eating, and they lose weight. I mean, it happens every single time. I've never seen it fail. So, and this is something that a lot of researchers are looking at where it's like carbohydrates, the empty carbohydrates, refined grains that are in all the processed foods, sugars, that's what's contributing to weight gain. And then, you know, eventually in many cases, the onset of chronic disease, where if we would just eat the regular old whole foods, we wouldn't have these problems. And so it's interesting because in the book, I talk about a study out of Harvard where they found that like for many homeless people, they were really obese. And so we have this situation now where people are overfed but undernourished. And so it seems contradictory, but it's really not because you're just taking in these empty calories that are not benefiting you, which in many cases is making people overweight and obese.
You know, that brings up something that you talk about a lot in the book, formerly known as Food. We're talking with Kristen Lawless, the author and fellow journalist and foodie, you know, and that is this calorie in, calorie out thing. You know, it's you really nail that. It's kind of like we develop these beliefs. It's not like we developed them, like you and I sat down and figured this out together or something, or, you know,
right.
Like my mother didn't figure it out. But it's somebody figures it out. It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
We have this
mm-hmm.
media. You and I both work in it. And then people pick up their ideas from it. And then at a certain point, and then it's really becomes entrenched thinking because everybody is saying this. Some doctors
right.
say it. Other people say it. We hear it all over. And then it becomes like a religion where everyone believes this. And they don't kind of understand, as perhaps we do in the media, that this didn't just arise, you know, naturally from the earth. It was created by somebody for some reason. You know, and the calorie Yes, it's a very big one. Yeah, I think you really, you know, let our readers, our listeners know a little bit more about that, because I think it's, you know, it's like a, mm-hmm. It's almost like religious belief at this point.
Yeah, this is like one of my biggest pet peeves, the whole idea that calories in, calories out, or that weight loss is dependent on how many calories you take in versus how many calories you burn via exercise and movement. This is the industry. The industry loves this idea because it allows them to keep producing terrible foods and then tell you that you can, one, eat anything. They love to say eat anything in moderation, which is incorrect. You should never eat those foods, even in moderation. And two, that you can, like, exercise your way out of bad diet, which research, there's just now an abundance of research to show that that, in fact, is also not true. And there are many scientists studying metabolism and endocrinology, and they're finding that, you know, all foods behave differently in the body. You can't, I give the example of, like, if you go to McDonald's and you get a burger, a fries, and a Coke, and it's, say, it's 700 or 900 calories or whatever it is, and or you roast a chicken at home with some broccoli and maybe drink some milk, and it's also the same amount of calories, of course those two meals are going to have a drastically different effect on the body. And so it actually doesn't make common sense when you think about it that way, but what the industry has done is really kind of, I mean, jumped on this idea, and it, like you said, everyone just accepts it. I mean, all the doctors do. That's the thing I had to really work against in educating people, because they would just say, oh, I'll just cut calories and I can just lose weight. Well, it's not. That's not the case, and there's plenty of science now to show that that's not the case.
Right. And then the other one that you talk about a lot is, you know, the problem with our understanding of toxins. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like you hear that all the time. I mean, we're looking, in the course of looking at what affects our health, as you do in your book, you know, you're looking at food additives, you're looking at food ingredients, you're also looking at toxic chemicals, all of that. And yet there's this idea of, oh, don't worry, you're being, you know, overly anxious, a little bit won't mm-hmm. hurt you. You know, that is like
right.
How mm-hmm. people look at toxins. And, you know, part of the problem is that scientists have to study something one thing at a time. But
mm-hmm.
that's not what's going on for us.
Right. Well, there's a couple issues, right? There's a couple issues there. One is that I mentioned earlier endocrine disrupting chemicals, and those are, like I said, substances that interfere with your hormonal system. And the way the hormonal system works is it operates by, you know, like, so for example, I give the example in the book of the birth control pill, where you're taking in this tiny, tiny dose of estrogen, and it has this huge effect in the body of preventing you from ovulating. So that's how hormones work. You can take in a tiny, tiny amount of a hormone, and you can see these big, huge biological effects. Well, the problem is these endocrine disruptors, so like BPA is a really one that people know about, very common in our food supply. Everybody, according to the CDC, has it in their bodies. This is a chemical that mimics the hormone estrogen. And so what industry will say is that, oh, well, you're only being exposed to trace amounts. They call it trace amounts, and they say that since that's the case, it's totally fine. It's not going to hurt you. Well, what the scientists in the book that I talked to are finding in their laboratories is that's not true at all, because it is a hormonally active substance. It has a huge effect on the body, even in tiny, tiny amounts. So this idea that, oh, it can't be that bad because it's this small amount is not true when you're talking about endocrine-disrupting chemicals, which they estimate there's maybe about 1,000 of them in the food supply. That's an estimate because no one really knows. And then that's the second point you mentioned, which is we're getting exposed to a combination of them all the time. Of course we are. There's no, you're not just eating one food every day. And so, you know, in one type of packaging or whatever. So you're getting exposed to tons of them all the time. And even the independent scientists that I highlight in the book are not studying combinations. There are a few that are, but not many, because it's so hard. And one of the scientists told me, you know, we're still trying to understand how all these chemicals work by themselves, never mind when you combine them, you know. And I think one of the researchers at the Consumers Union told me he wouldn't be surprised if the average person in this country is taking in up to 100 different types of, you know, additives, environmental chemicals, et cetera, just throughout the day. So, you know, we need to, this is like my argument in the book is, this is why it's not about personal choice or consumer choice. It's about why aren't these agencies like the FDA or the EPA regulating what's in our food? That's what their job is. We pay them with our tax dollars, and they should be protecting the public health.
Definitely. I mean, one of the things I really also love about the book so much is that, you know, for example, I've had countless medical experts on this program. I've interviewed many more, you know, worked with many different people over the years. And, you know, and actually this is where I began from in becoming interested in writing about these issues and everything and practicing them in my own life, which is, you know, what choices can we make to eat healthier food? Like, you know, mm-hmm. you and I both belong to the food co-op, for example, but not mm-hmm. everybody lives in a neighborhood where there is an ethnically diverse population all able mm-hmm. to afford and buy this healthier food because we're all contributing our work, which helps in doing the jobs that have to be done, which means that they don't have to pay staff, and the prices become more affordable. But, you know, but what we're always taught is people, you know, you have to do it. You have to make a choice. You know, and all mm-hmm. of the advice on this comes from healthcare providers who are, you know, kind of exhorting people in book after book after book. I mean, your book is very rare in the health and food book marketplace because it's not primarily you know, I'm a doctor, I'm an authority, I'm going to tell you what to do, you just mm-hmm. do what I tell you and all will be well, you should eat this,
yeah.
rather than, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Your comments on that, I mean,
well,
who does that
I mean,
leave
I set out to, well, I set out to write the book, you know, that would just let everyone know, look, this is what's happening with the food supply, there are so many issues, and I don't think there's just like, there's not like one diet cure or whatever that people like to sell, you know, books based on that. I'm not interested in that. I wanted to get to the larger issues. And you know, one of my critiques in the book is that this idea that we can just like vote with our fork and buy our, you know, go to the farmers
right.
market and get organic food and like all these things are just consumer based ideas about how we can create change. And when you look, that's not how change actually works. And so what's happened is we have like two food systems. We have a food system for the people that can afford and have access and all these other things to healthy and organic, et cetera, foods. And then you have the food system for the rest of Americans who is the vast majority of Americans who are just eating the regular food. And so, of course, the industry profits on both fronts there because they can keep making their terrible foods that are feeding a lot of people, and then they can have this whole organic, booming organic industry that they can capitalize off of too. So this is why I argue that what we need to do as consumers is actually come together in our communities and start demanding that, you know, like, for example, things are regulated, as I mentioned. Like, why should, you know, why should anyone get anyone's children be exposed to all these harmful environmental chemicals? Why is it, you know, it doesn't, it's just like we need to think more broadly in terms of how we're going to create real change for the entire public, not just the people that, you know, are fortunate to, you know, like you said, you know, go to the co-op.
Right. Or, you know, make raw food dishes, you know, based on Gwyneth Paltrow's
mm-hmm.
recipes or whatever. I'm in complete agreement. And yet there's a kind of, in discussing this, I find that there's kind of like almost a wall, as if people who, you know, are eating poor quality food because of lower economic means are somehow not our concern. I, you know, I'm sort of shocked to share this story, but I was at a health conference recently, and I was talking with a healthcare provider there who does very high-end customized services that are enormously helpful for people, but they're, you know, they're not part of the standard protocol that's offered, you know, by health insurance companies and the government and everything like that. But we were talking
mm-hmm.
about that, and I said, well, but so many of these things are not a matter of personal choice. What about the people who can't afford to eat healthy food, for
right.
example? And this man said to me, well, there have always been the haves and the have-nots. And then he, in effect,
right.
like shrugged. And
mm-hmm.
that was like the end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure you've heard these kinds of things as well in the work mm-hmm. that you've done. But it's kind of like if you're in a healing arts profession, where does your compassion and concern kind of stop like that, you know, and
right.
kind of go,
yeah.
well, they can't pay my, even so even among people who are really using superb holistic practice, which this guy was,
mm-hmm.
it's like dependent mm-hmm. on a certain kind of elitism.
Of course. But it's also completely short-sighted and also inaccurate because, like, all of these chemicals are in our environment all the time. So even if you're like this person and you're, you know, you mentioned and you're avoiding all these foods and you're eating so well yourself, well, guess what? All the stuff is everywhere all the time. It's not just about, you know, it's like in the water, it's in the soil, it's, you know, it's just the plastic packaging. Think about where that ends up. I mean, it ends up in the oceans and then it gets filtered back into the food chain that you eat, you know, you're like your wild-caught fish or whatever. So it's very short-sighted to say that because I just have to keep reminding people that whatever we do to our environment, we do to ourselves and our bodies as well. So it's not just about, you know, some people have access and some don't. We're all in this situation here, you know.
You're right, actually. That is actually the literal truth. So even if I'm over here with my pristine tomato, you know,
mm-hmm.
the drift from the GMO corn field or,
mm-hmm.
you know, the contaminants from the other plastics or additives, they are all entering
right.
my food as well. And there is
of
no
course,
separation. So, you know,
no.
who knows? I mean, one of the things, one of the great beliefs is that somehow, you know, I can be a success and, you know, whatever happens to them is none of my business. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
our society is predicated on a lot of that. But this stuff really
mm-hmm.
is teaching those who are paying attention that it's just not so. So we're coming down
okay.
to our final minutes of
mm-hmm.
talking with you, Kristen. And our book today has been Fully Known as Food by Kristen Law. This has been a really terrific conversation. Actually, it's a really great book. And I said that before, and I'm saying it again. I'm somebody who's really well-versed in these issues. And I have to say, I love the way you formulate them. I love the way you talk about them. The book is very accessible and very wise at the same time. I really love the book. And it's not for nothing that you have a back cover quote not only from Mark Bittman, but also from Naomi Klein, who is, you know, our leading environmental reporter of these times, and that's a real compliment
oh, yeah.
and also well-deserved.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being with us today,
thank
Kristen.
You.
It's been really a pleasure. And
thank you, Allison.
I wish you all luck with this book. Everybody go buy it because, you know, there are too many books telling you this false story of your consumer choice, as Kristen points out, and too few that do what this book does. So please do support it by buying Formerly Known as Food. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today on Connect the Dots, and great thanks to you, Kristen.
Thank you.
We will be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Well, and there was me, and there was I.